This is the takeaway for Monday, December 4th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Over the weekend, author and journalist Suki Kim, who's been a guest on this program, published an article in New York Magazine accusing former Takeaway host John Hockenberry of sexual harassment and, in some cases, sexual assault and workplace bullying. Suki herself said she was the recipient of persistent and unwanted attention from John Hockenberry. Several former women producers and interns for The Takeaway then told Suki their stories of being harassed, of receiving unwanted attention, and in some cases, being kissed without their consent. John Hockenberry does not deny these allegations. Separately, two former hosts of this show, longtime co-host Celeste Headlee and Farai Chidea, who filled in as an interim co-host for several months, recounted stories of being bullied and, as Celeste puts it, professionally sabotaged. These stories have outraged and disappointed and saddened us here at The Takeaway. But they also raise important questions. We invited Farai Chidea on today, and also Kristen Meinzer, a former Takeaway producer and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, who was one of the women who came forward in Suki's piece. They both said they want to hear management from our parent station, WNYC, go on the air first. We have reached out to both WNYC Leadership and Public Radio International. Those are the two entities that own The Takeaway. We also invited WNYC President and CEO Laura Walker on the program today, as well as Dean Capello, WNYC's Chief Content Officer, who for a long time oversaw many elements of The Takeaway. They both declined. You can read New York Public Radio's full statement as well as PRI statement by heading over to our website at thetakeaway.org. With me now is Suki Kim, investigative journalist and author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. She reported this story in New York Magazine. Suki, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Suki, tell me why you started asking women who've worked on or around The Takeaway about their experiences with John Hockenberry. What made you pursue this story?
Well, I was on the show in December 2014, because that's when my book had come out, where, you know, I went undercover and lived in North Korea. And I was contacted by John Hockenberry, the host, nearly a year later, for a meeting he requested through my publicist. So I met with him, and he said that, you know, it was a brainstorming meeting, except he wouldn't really tell me what we were brainstorming. And then that's when these emails began, which were always a little bit borderline, you know, like asking to meet at a museum or just like slightly too intimate for a work correspondence. And I mean, that's the difficulty with those emails as a woman writer or just a worker, that you are not, it's hard to pinpoint what is wrong with them. But these emails just continued and continued, and he kept asking for a meeting, and I met with him again in June 2016, and that's when the emails turned, incredibly, to me, inappropriate, one of which was Need Another Dose of You, was how it was titled. And then I stopped replying back. And up until then, I had replied professionally. And then his emails just kept arriving and arriving. And he was emailing me until 2017, January. I mean, look, I met him in 2014 in December for 8 minutes. And these emails continued. And I couldn't actually, it was disrupting my work, because I would also separately get requests from Takeaway producers to come on the show as a guest, and I didn't want to be interviewed by the host. So as I was stuck getting this request and not able to reply, I realized that I needed to just warn the radio station. So I came here to Takeaway to report the incident with HR. And then, months later, I heard that he retired suddenly, which then began, I wondered, you know, if he was sending those emails to me and I was on the show for 8 minutes, then what is going on with all these young women who are stuck working with him in an office on a daily basis? So that's what began the whole investigation.
You turned and you asked women who worked on The Takeaway and had worked on The Takeaway about their own experiences with John. What did they tell you?
It was kind of amazing how very quickly I was able to, you know, hear these stories of abuse, you know, whether it was, you know, I spoke to so many women, and they generally take away, there are lots and lots of women among its staff, generally also quite young, mostly under 40, it seems. And I realized that, two different kinds of abuse were taking place. You know, women who were of higher rank, which there aren't many, there were co-hosts and these guest hosts. And these women did not really, there was no sexual breach as far as I could tell, or they'd never seen it. And then there were younger women who were producers, interns, freelancers. And with them, the inappropriateness was sexual harassment, where physical contact was involved, unwanted contact, as well as these late night G-chats he would send them really late at night, and they were all, you know, generally inappropriate, generally making them really feel uncomfortable sexually. So it was very clear that, it divided into two sets of abuse that was taking place for a decade, pretty much.
Some of the women you spoke to described unwanted attention from John. Some women described inappropriate sexual encounters, including kissing when they didn't want to be kissed.
Right. I mean, I think what was common with those stories were how scared they were, because younger women generally, you know, didn't have much power on the show. And Huckleberry was at the top of the show. He basically, it was all about him, really, the whole show. He's the oldest person on the show. You know, he's the hero of the show. He's the supposedly the genius of the show. All these young women were in awe of him. And I'm not saying all of them said negative things. Some women were, you know, exceptionally positive about Huckleberry being their mentor. In a way, some of them felt indebted to him for their career. But that, for some other women, went hand in hand, where he's sort of a mentor. They never really experienced the really screaming at them kind of horrible treatment that women who are more his equal, the co-hosts, who are Adora Doji, Celeste Headlee, Farai Chidea, what those three women experienced is very different from what the young women experienced, younger women experienced. So basically, what was really disturbing as I dug deeper and deeper into this investigation, which really wiped me out for over a month, just talking to anyone that I could possibly talk to about what was going on here at Takeaway for a decade, was that the levels of abuse and harassment were sort of these multiple levels of them.
Suki, before I let you go, I want to read a little bit from John Huckleberry's statement that he sent to WNYC through a spokesman and to you, and get your reaction. He says, "It horrifies me that I made the talented and driven people I worked with feel uncomfortable, and that the stress around putting together a great show was made worse by my behavior. Having to deal with my own physical limitations has given me an understanding of powerlessness, and I should have been more aware of how the power I wielded over others, coupled with inappropriate comments and communications, could have been construed. I have no excuses." Suki, your reaction.
I'm not sure if I have a reaction to that, but I have a question for you, actually, because you have said, I've seen your tweet over the weekend, that you're very surprised and in shock. I just don't understand how you could have not seen, if you've been here for a decade, where almost everyone I talked to were aware of an abuse happening around Huckleberry on either level, and also considering three co-hosts, women of color, had all left after filing complaint, mm-hmm. which essentially shut down the younger women. They couldn't complain because, you know, really powerful women complained and they were let go, really, by the management who did not protect any of those women. So, I mean, since you're a journalist and journalist's job description is to be perceptive, how could you not have seen? I'm not putting you on the spot, but I guess I am in a way. I'm
Suki,
curious, genuinely.
It's all right to put me on the spot because I have something that I want to say to takeaway listeners now on the back of your report. Let me outro you, Suki Kim, author and journalist who reported this story in New York Magazine. And Suki, don't go away because I want you to hear what I have to say to takeaway listeners that I think goes right to your story. People might be wondering, did I know about John Hockenberry's behavior? Was I aware of it? Did I do anything to stop it? And it is a fair question. And the answer is, I never witnessed John harass or bully anyone. Until I started hosting the show, I was Washington correspondent. I lived and worked in D.C., and I wasn't in the office with the rest of the team day to day. When I did come to New York, it was almost always when John was gone. These last few years, I was his fill-in. We were like ships passing in the night a lot of times.
What about the fact that three women were let go back-to-back after filing complaints, which almost everybody knew? And also the fact the show is about diversity, which is led by a white man, really, John Hockenberry, where all the women of color were somehow, they had to leave the show. And it's still, you're a white man hosting the show, yeah. And you didn't get fired.
Well,
like those, I mean, you didn't have to leave the show,
Suki,
for a decade.
Conversations about John's outbursts and his meanness did come up among the staff in chatter and over drinks. And you know, one thing that I used to say when John's bullying came up, whether it had to do with other hosts or with members of the staff, I felt like one of the lucky ones. John never trained his ire on me, not directly anyway. And I ask myself now, because I never asked then, why? Why was I spared? And the truth is, I don't know why I was spared John's ire, but given the other things we do know now, thanks to your reporting, it's possible John could have seen me, another white male, as less of a target. Was I privileged in my workplace because the star of the show, even subconsciously, saw me differently than some of my coworkers? Because if so, that's a problem. You know, as much as we say our workplace is a family, it's not a family. It's a job, and no one working hard on the job deserves to be treated differently because of their race or their gender or their identity or their sexual orientation. And if I was treated differently by John Hockenberry, that's something to deal with, and it's something we're going to keep talking about on this show. And Suki, I want to thank you for airing out this story. I want to thank you for reporting it and especially for agreeing to come on The Takeaway with me. And here's my pledge to you, Suki Kim, and to everyone listening to me right now, wherever this story goes. We'll keep covering it, and we'll keep listening to you. We ran out of time with Suki Kim in the last segment, so we asked her if she wanted to add anything else. Here's what she said.
Look, I think I didn't realize the time passed like that. I think that management did not protect these women, and everybody turned a blind eye because I was looking into this, for a month? You know, these people have been there for a decade. There have been multiple complaints. And nobody protected the women for a decade. Can I just say one more? The sexual harassment, racial discrimination that was going on at Takeaway, professional harassment against women that went on for a decade was not a secret to anybody. Nearly everybody that I talked to seemed aware of it. So then why did the management do nothing when there had been multiple complaints?
The victims of this treatment were producers and interns, two of his black female co-hosts, and a fill-in co-host who is also African-American. So in this moment of reckoning over sexual harassment and assault and workplace harassment, a reckoning that has hit us square in the eyes here on The Takeaway, are women of color being heard? Is this movement, you can call it Me Too if you want, is it just about some women? Rebecca Carroll is here. She's special projects producer for WNYC. Rebecca, thanks for being in the studio.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Rebecca, here's where I want to start. You had some of your own experiences with John Hockenberry as a guest on this show and an employee at the station at WNYC. Can you tell me a little bit about your own experience?
Sure. I had been at this job at the station probably 2 weeks when John invited me to a staff meeting to introduce me to his staff and to talk about ways in which I might be able to work with them in whatever capacity. And probably inside 30 seconds, he said to me in front of the staff, "If it feels like a slave plantation mentality here, that's because it is." And then proceeded to, without gauging my response at all, talk about all of his sort of efforts to champion Black voices during his tenure on the show.
What did that experience say to you? What did it leave you with?
Well, it's not, you know, I mean, our own Ilya Marritz reported for WNYC and mentioned, and I've spoken with him about this, but he referred to it as a sort of racially tinged moment. To me, that's not racially tinged. That's racially offensive. And I think what's really deeply important, some folks know that I was also a producer for The Charlie Rose Show and have talked some about my experience there. The similarities are just striking. You know, he was the show, these over-the-top egos, the narcissism, the berating, the belittling, all the rest. But importantly, these men created sort of micro fiefdoms, if you will, silos that sort of replicate a kind of white supremacy and patriarchy, which is inherently racist and sexist. So that will invariably involve racial and sexual denigration. Now, we're focusing primarily and have until now on the sexual harassment piece of it, an aspect of it, because most of the stories that have come forward and made public have been made by white women. But it's now with this story, Suki's story, and talking a little bit more about the ways in which women of color have this double burden and whether even, you know, it's not to take away from the sexual harassment stories of white women or women of color, for that matter, but to just directly connect the dots to the ways in which a environment that allows for sexual harassment also allows for racial denigration and racism.
Let me bring it back to the takeaway for now, and because I want to keep talking about this show and our experience here, which you were involved in, Rebecca. The women in question in Suki's story, Kristen Meinzer, former host Adora Udoji, Celeste Headlee for iChadea, you, fill-in guests, longtime guests on the show, all women of color. And the allegations aren't limited to them, but these are the ones whose identities are known in Suki's story. What did you take away when you read Suki's story, when you talked to her, when you heard other reports on WNYC, when you look across the range of the women who are named in this story, all women of color? I want to know what your reaction was to that and what it is now a couple of days later.
So I have not spoken with Suki directly, but I, of course, read the piece. And, you know, I mean, it feels like a moment of reckoning. It feels like it's high time. It feels like these are all women who I greatly admire and respect. And I think that you know, it's a moment to be listened to, which is quite remarkable because women of color, Black women specifically, and I can only speak, you know, as a Black woman, are not listened to. We know that Black women and women of color are sexually harassed as much, if not more, than white women, but we don't come forward because there's so much more at stake and at risk. So I think it's a moment of reckoning, and I'm very grateful for it.
Rebecca, I'm the host of this show. I'm the interim host of this show. I have a platform here. Another white guy hosting The Takeaway. There have been women of color as co-hosts. They've gone away for various reasons. John, for whatever reason, and I think it's worth talking about, was the one left standing when all of those other people went away. John is now gone, and here I am hosting this show, again, with this platform. How do you think I can best use it, given what we're talking about?
Well, I think you have to hold yourself accountable. I think you have to ask. I would like to ask you, I would like you to ask yourself, is it lost on you that you are succeeding a white man as a white male host of a show that started with a mission of diversity and inclusivity? What is your role? What is your role in that? And I think that it's a matter of accountability and feeling really, really unclear. You're going to feel unclear, but that's really the start. You have to come undone. You have to undo what you have been thinking, because whatever it was that you were thinking allowed you a certain level of obtusity around this whole issue.
One of the things I said to Suki at the top of the show is that I never really seriously questioned why, when John was training his aggression at times on other people, why it was never trained on me. I was kind of happy for it, to be honest, because it was nice to not be subjected to harassment or screaming. John and I didn't see each other a whole lot. And I felt lucky, like I said, but I never did ask, why am I being spared? I said this at the top of the show. I want to say it again. I never did ask, why am I being spared that?
And I would ask you, why did you not ask yourself that?
I never thought to. I just felt lucky that it wasn't me.
And now you know that you didn't have to, right?
Yeah. You know what? I also heard stories around drinks or chatter. Of course, takeaway employees talked about John's outbursts or his meanness. You know, that came up too. You would hear it when you would socialize with your colleagues. And another thing I never did, even though I never witnessed it directly because I wasn't here much, I never marched up to John and said, hey, I've been hearing stuff about you. Knock it off. Knock it off. I could have done that. He could have told me to get lost. I don't know. I never did that.
Do you think you would if you had the chance to do it again?
In retrospect, if I could now, yeah, I could. And I regret it. I regret it. I wish I had that chance now, Rebecca. And that's part of the regret that situations like this bring. And look, I'm not a victim here because the victims here were the ones who John did harass. The victims are the ones who he did abuse, who he did scream at, who he did kiss.
I can assure you that you will have the opportunity to stand up for women in the future of your career.
And I intend to use it. And I appreciate you coming here, Rebecca Carroll, Special Projects, WNYC. Thank you.
Sure.
Welcome back, and thanks for being with us today. It's Todd Zwillick, and we spent all last week here on The Takeaway talking about the future of the Democratic Party. Democrats, you sounded off on what you want your party to look like. Well, Republicans, this week, it's your turn. At first glance, the GOP is riding high. 32 Republican-controlled state legislatures, 34 governor seats, and in Washington, control of the Senate and the House, and of course, the White House. But does all that winning point to a healthy party? There's no way to say that it does. The GOP is in the throes of a takeover. The party's dream, repealing Obamacare with a unified Congress, failed. The party of family values appears solidly behind a Senate candidate in Alabama credibly accused of molesting girls. And its leader, President Trump, has pushed white nationalist identity politics to the core of the party. Meanwhile, his former political advisor, Steve Bannon, is on the outside now, working, he says, to unseat party leaders like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. So where is this Republican Party headed? We begin today with the establishment. Doug High is former communications director for the Republican National Committee and also the former deputy chief of staff for House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Doug High is a never-Trumper who's worried about where his party is headed and that Roy Moore's possible election isn't the bottom.
So I didn't vote for Trump. I wrote in Paul Ryan. That is a bit of an admission of defeat, admittedly. I reflect at least a part of the party that is really struggling to come to grips with all of this because there are a lot of things that Trump's going to do that I like. Then there's the daily barrage of kind of self-created outrage du jour that I don't think serves the American people well. I don't think serves this White House well. And I envisioned the Republican primary was going to be finally mom and dad having the necessary fight in front of the kids. To me, that meant Rand and Ted and whomever on one side and Jeb and Marco and whomever on the other side, and they would fight it out and we would resolve our differences. Then along came the crazy uncle. And so part of the thing that I struggle with is there's going to be a point where there's not a President Trump. And that could be in 1 year, 3 years, 7 years. But when we come to that point, will mom and dad finally resolve their differences? And I don't think we know the answer to that yet. But what we've certainly seen is that the ground beneath Republican candidates, Republican members of Congress has really shifted, and it shifted very quickly. They're struggling to come to grips with it. And it's something that every time they go home during a recess, they're more and more surprised at some of the changes that they've heard and how tribal those changes are.
How tribal they are. Doug, that fight that Republicans need to have in front of the kids that they mentioned, what is it? Because it's not just deregulation, taxes, and a strong military the way it used to be. The other side of that fight, frankly, is a brand of white ethno-nationalism that Donald Trump brought to this party and was then elected with 80 or 90% of Republican support.
Yeah, and if you talk to Republican voters, I've spent a lot of this year in North Carolina, and you know what I've heard over and over again in a state that Trump won but didn't win massively is that Republican voters not only aren't going anywhere from away from Trump, that they are more and more in favor of him, in part as a rejection of Washington, the media, the corporate media, as they look at it. And I hear a lot of talk of what I would call, yeah, but Republicans. And this is what I've heard so many times is, yeah, this particular tweet, whatever tweet it was or comment it was on any given day, isn't really helpful, comma, but, and then it's some variation of Trump taking the fight to people they want to take the fight to, even if it's Hillary Clinton or people like that who really aren't current fixtures in American politics, but remain a fixture to a lot of Republican voters and certainly conservative media.
Let's talk about the future a little bit. One of the features here is clearing out the old guard from the GOP. Where does this shake out?
Well, I don't think we know yet. We're learning a lot, and we'll certainly learn, you know, about what happens in Alabama. That's certainly a race where you have Roy Moore, who's campaigning as much against Mitch McConnell as he is, you know, for or against anything else. Yeah, I think it says that we have real problems. Very obviously, we have real problems. I'm appalled at what's going on. And, you know, the party faces a lose-lose situation in Alabama. If Roy Moore wins, he is our next Todd Akin, Richard Murdoch, Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Engel. You know, four Senate seats that we basically left on the table, which if we had had better candidates win those primaries, we could have passed Obamacare repeal and replace. We could have already passed the tax reform bill. And then if he loses, well, we've also got a problem of, you know, a real sign of a seismic wave that may be coming against Republicans. But if you get outside of Washington, D.C., you know, and the kind of D.C., New York, Acela corridor, you find very quickly just how high the level of disdain is for anything that smacks of Washington or anything that smacks of the media. And so, you know, what we've seen with Roy Moore supporters, and I think we'll see this with other candidates, even less extreme ones, is a calcification of support around them because they stand against these institutions that have no credibility outside of Washington, D.C. Roy Moore, I think, is going to win. But, you know, I think that what we've also seen in politics now, you know, and President Trump is proof of this, is as things have become so tribal, things have become so team-based that, you know, Donald Trump has proven you don't quit. And ultimately, what we see is that if you don't quit, your team will back you in the end. And it's that kind of tribalism that worries me moving forward.
And going forward, I wonder what you see as the future of your party. There has been an embrace of an essentially ethnic, pro-white, anti-diversity message at the core of the Republican base now. That's what Donald Trump represents. It seems to transcend all of the other ideological things and policy preferences that used to glue the GOP together, like taxes and regulation and national security. All of those things are secondary to white ethno-nationalism in the GOP base now. What's the way out? Is there one?
Well,
should there be?
I tend not to even think in those terms. I you know, there's apparently some green frog cartoon character that is some white nationalist thing, right? I don't know what any of that means. I don't know what a snowflake is. I don't know what a cuck is. All of that kind of stuff that's popped up over the past couple years. I don't know what any of that means.
No, but Doug, but you do know what a president tweeting anti-Muslim rhetoric in videos
is.
But remains at 35% popularity and 70 plus in your party. That's
right.
That's something that you can't miss.
No. I would say one, you have those yeah but voters that I you know mentioned earlier who don't love that but love the other stuff that he's doing. I certainly talked a lot in the 2016 elections of what I saw problems for Trump and for the White House or for Republicans moving forward. In part of that, you know, I looked at my own state of North Carolina. I'll give you an example. Anybody who grew up like I did watching the Andy Griffith Show, which is kind of gospel in North Carolina, knows about the town of Siler City. I went there last year and I was amazed at the, you know, number of Hispanic businesses in downtown, small town, Siler City. We need to win those voters if we want to have a long-term viability. But the resounding message from the election says that maybe, you know, what I think the future of the party should be isn't what the future of the party is going to be. And if we want to put together a coalition, not a coalition, but a base of, you know, disgruntled white voters, we can do that for an election or two. How that's a path for long-term viability, I don't know. That's one of the things that, you know, Republicans, I think Republicans who want to grow the party and want to go back to, you know, really accomplishing things, be results-oriented, are trying to figure out how to do. The problem is there aren't a lot of good answers right now.
Does it make you feel partly responsible that some of the things you may have done working for House members might have also helped create this?
No. In fact, you know, I think almost every day what I was focused on in the House of Representatives was trying to put better, you know, better results out there. And, you know, part of that is also because, which never really gets talked about, one of the things that always gets the blame for why the country or why the Republican Party is where it is redistricting. And I understand that redistricting plays a role, but we also forget that we've changed our laws in the past 10 years, more than 10 years now, in a very significant manner. So I go back to the McCain-Feingold campaign law, where we basically took the money out of the Republican National Committee. So I saw in 2010 us really struggling to raise money for several reasons, but McCain-Feingold and this other thing called Citizens United playing a role in it. And the money leaving the party had to go places. So where did it go? Well, it went to the Heritage Foundation, and it went to this new political organization called Heritage Action. It went to Club for Growth. It went to American Crossroads and the American Action Network and all these other kind of outside organizations. Democrats have the kind of same mirror images as we do. And so what we saw was that now you had financial incentives to, you know, cast apostates within your own party, so that the problem wasn't Barack Obama. The problem was Eric Cantor and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And we would see scoring of votes in the House. You covered a lot of these, where House of Representative votes would be scored so that we could castigate good Republicans versus bad Republicans. And sometimes Senate votes were not. And we found out that, well, that was because Ted voted the wrong way. So that vote wasn't going to be scored. And so if you have outside institutions that make money and raise money by further balkanizing the party within itself, that also gives rise to exactly where we are right now, especially when you have certain organs of the media that not only echo that and amplify that, but really become a participant in it. That's part of the challenge that that I saw every day. But what I also ended up, unfortunately, having to do every day was, in some fashion, dealing with Republicans fighting with each other. And we spent so much time fighting with ourselves. Who's a good Republican? Who's a bad Republican? Who's a true conservative? Who's a true believer? All that kind of, frankly, nonsense that didn't help us pass conservative outcomes. And that ultimately is, you know, what I said earlier about mom and dad having the fight in front of the kids. And you're right, there is a strain of, you know, we certainly saw a lot of this in Charlottesville and so forth. And full disclosure, my first campaign was in 1990 working for Jesse Helms. So I've seen race in the Republican Party up close, working for Jesse Helms, Michael Steele, the first African-American RNC chair, and then Eric Cantor, the highest ranking elected Jewish Republican. But this is the battle the party eventually has to have with itself. We saw a hostile takeover of the party from Trump. This is where the party finds itself. This is where the party finds itself right now with Roy Moore, you know, that we're even having a discussion of not just what he did and what his other policies are too, which aren't necessarily too popular with Washington Republicans, but also whether or not we're going to seat him, whether or not he will be removed, you know, for somebody who hasn't been elected yet, that's rather unprecedented. But that's where the party finds itself right now. And the crazy thing about it to me is, on paper, the Republican Party has never been in better shape than it is right now. We have massive hold on state legislatures, on governors. We have a majority in the House, in the Senate, and we have the White House. And yet you can certainly argue that the Republican Party is at a lowest point that it has ever been. I would only argue against that, saying I think we've got a ways to go, and Roy Moore is a symptom of that.
You think the Republican Party has a ways more to go downward?
Absolutely. I think it's very clear in what we saw in the elections earlier this month, and I don't mean in the Gillespie-Northam race. You know, the governor's races tend to be, you know, as much about you know, the individual state and the two candidates who are running as anything else. But in the state legislature races, where we saw massive Democratic pickups, that should suggest to Republicans that we've got a real problem on our hands. And so, you know, we'll certainly see Democratic gains. We are seeing some signs right now of a potential wave. Obviously, it's a year away and anything can happen. But what happens to the Republican Party if Democrats take over the House and or the Senate? I can't tell you that I know the answer. I only know that the finger pointing and the recriminations will be massive.
Doug High is former communications director for the Republican National Committee and former deputy chief of staff to House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Doug, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. We go now to the war in Yemen. Earlier today, a radio station operated by the Houthi-controlled Interior Ministry reported that former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh has been killed. There's still no official confirmation of his death, but videos purporting to show his dead body have begun circulating on social media. We'll keep following this story as more details emerge, but we're going to focus today on America's role in the war in Yemen. At the start of November, 22 humanitarian groups issued a stark warning. Yemen had just 6 weeks of food aid remaining for 7 million Yemenis facing famine. The humanitarian crisis has also caught the attention of Congress. In mid-November, the House adopted a resolution calling for more humanitarian access and an end to civilian casualties in Yemen. It was a weakened resolution, but still aimed squarely at Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have sustained bombing over Yemen for years. They've been blocking ports in Yemen. Already, an estimated 10,000 civilians have been killed in Yemen's war. Before the weekend, I spoke with the sponsor of that resolution. Congressman Ro Khanna is a freshman Democrat from California's 17th Congressional District in Silicon Valley.
The resolution recognizes that any involvement or aid to the Saudis in their campaign in Yemen is unauthorized under the 2001 authorization of force. It recognizes the humanitarian catastrophe that is unfolding in Yemen with nearly 900,000 individuals facing cholera, almost 7 million facing the potential of famine. And finally, it calls for a greater access to humanitarian assistance, opening up the ports, opening up the airports to allow humanitarian aid.
Now, when you talk to colleagues about this, maybe colleagues who are in favor of U.S. involvement here, what do they say to you about the strategic imperative? What do they say to you when they say, Ro, we got to stay in Yemen because what?
Well, there are two reasons to be in Yemen. One, everyone recognizes, and that is that there is an al-Qaeda presence. We have counterterrorism operations there. And nothing in my original resolution or the compromise resolution would restrict the United States' counterterrorism operations in Yemen. Then there's the broader issue of should we be taking the Saudis' side in the civil war with the Houthis. Those who believe we should be assisting the Saudi campaign argue that Iran has had a huge influence with the Houthis. There is a dispute about how involved Iran has been. My own view is that Iran escalated its involvement after the Saudis' bombing campaign, and that the Iranian role, at least initially, was exaggerated. But even if you accept the view that Iran is involved, I still don't think that the United States should be actively engaged in a proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. I don't think that does anything to make us safer, and I don't think that's going to bring peace or stability in Yemen. But those who are arguing for aid to Saudi often are arguing for it in the context of an Iranian threat.
Well, we watched as President Trump visited Saudi Arabia early in his presidency and celebrated hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons deals to Saudi Arabia. It's pretty clear the administration is going in the opposite direction to what you describe. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of Democrats, including in your own leadership, are okay with it.
Well, I think the question is, what is making us safer and why are we providing this aid to the Saudis? I think the administration, and in candor, the Obama administration had approved $115 billion sale to the Saudis. as well, and I was part of the Obama administration, not when they approved that, and I have great admiration for President Obama. But this has not just been a problem with this president. It's been a problem of American foreign policy. So the question is, how do we shift? And the shift in thinking needs to be a shift of paradigm from realpolitik, or this idea that we need a counter or balance to Iran. President Obama made so much progress with the Iran deal, and people convinced him that they needed to do something for the Saudis to make up for that. And that led in part to the approval of weapons, and it led to, in perhaps, a blind eye to the Saudis' campaign in Yemen, or if not some active support. I do believe if President Obama were in office now and saw the extent of the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, that he would have reevaluated the Saudi relationship. President Trump so far has been unwilling to. Nikki Haley, actually, the ambassador to the UN, has expressed concern about the humanitarian consequences. So to summarize, I think two things. First, regardless of the politics, we can all agree that the Saudis should allow humanitarian assistance to flow into Yemen. That should not be a political issue. And frankly, the Trump administration has tremendous leverage over Saudi Arabia to make that happen. The second issue is, how do we reevaluate the relationship with the Saudis, recognizing that we can't totally destabilize Saudi Arabia? That would potentially lead to more terrorism and a greater threat to the United States. But we don't have to actively be aiding the Saudis in their wars in other countries, whether it's in Lebanon, whether it's in Yemen, and that the Saudis are not popular among many other countries in Muslim-majority nations, and it's not making us more friends around the world, and it's actually making us more of a target of terrorism.
Ro Khanna, Democratic congressman from the 17th District in California. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about that tax bill the Senate GOP passed just before 2 a.m. on Saturday. A 51-49 vote with just Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee breaking from his party. Senators are now working to negotiate a final bill with the House, but this plan has some Democrats, like Jason Furman, sounding an alarm.
Overall, at best, this bill would leave little for the middle class. At worst, tens of millions would see a tax increase. And in any circumstance, they'll be left holding the bag for the over $1 trillion price tag of the bill.
Jason Furman is professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. He was also chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama.
We all believe in the American dream. We all believe that everyone should get a fair shot to move up the income ladder. And this bill could get in the way of that. First of all, it cuts back on subsidies for higher education in a way that would make it harder for low-income students to go to college. At the same time, at the other end of the spectrum, the Senate bill cuts the estate tax, the House bill repeals it, and by cutting it, it would increase the intergenerational transmission of wealth and reduce mobility.
We'll talk a little bit more about your view of the top end here. The repeal of the estate tax has been a dream for Republicans for a long, long time. We'll see if they get it repealed entirely here. But how much of an impact would repealing the estate tax have on the wealth that the top earners in this country get to pass on to their kids?
First of all, it's important to understand the estate tax. Right now, it affects 2 out of every 1,000 families. 998 out of 1,000 have wealth that falls below the threshold, which is already $11 million for a married couple. At a minimum, this bill would double that threshold. It might eliminate the estate tax entirely, and that would just make it much easier to transmit wealth from one generation to the next, lead to dynastic fortunes, and take away some of the money that we would need to pay for the types of programs that would help fuel mobility.
But listen, Jason, you know what Republicans say about the economic policies, for instance, of the Obama White House, why they haven't allowed the economy to chug along. They say that lower taxes, especially for corporations, will free up a lot more money for investment, and that investment will lead to more hiring, more jobs.
The nonpartisan and, in fact, Republican-appointed Joint Committee on Taxation said that the Senate bill would add less than 0.1 percentage point to the growth rate. That is, in fact, what every economic model that takes into account the extra debt has found. And I think actually over the longer run, whatever small benefits there are to cutting tax rates would be more than outweighed by the economic cost of a large increase in the debt.
Well, Jason Furman, Democrats have not gotten a say in these tax bills, and they're not going to if it reaches the president's desk. What's your bottom line when you look at the balance here between tax cuts, eliminating some of the tax write-offs, and the estate tax cuts at the top?
I think on balance, this is a bill that will exacerbate inequality, that will add to our budget deficit, that may cause a little bit of extra growth, especially in the short run, but over the longer run, any of those benefits will be undermined by the increase in the debt. So I think overall, you know, it was a real missed opportunity to actually do a meaningful reform of the type that we did on a bipartisan basis in 1986.
Jason Furman, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama. Jason, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we leave you today, it seems like a good day to do something we don't do very often on the show, and that's credits. The Takeaway is produced by Isabel Angel, Alexandra Botee, Jake Howitt, Vince Fairchild, Rob Gunther, Amber Hall, Oliver Lazarus, Ethan Oberman, Dana Roberson, and Elizabeth Ross. We had help today from Sarah Kirsten. Nicole Rothwell is our intern. TJ Raphael is our digital producer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. Ellen Frankman is our senior producer. And our executive producer is Irva Gunja. I'm Todd Zwillick, interim host of The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening and for being with us today. More tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by ACLU, which works nationwide to protect the constitutional rights of all people. ACLU.org. ACLU. We the people. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Public Radio International.